A birthday is an occasion just to rejoice in the fact of being alive. I think as we consider Israel's 23rd birthday, it's well to remember that she is alive, doing very well. We tend to get so overwhelmed by the shadow of the headlines. We forget that life goes on, children are born, go to school, get married, families go to the beaches on picnics, that they go to lectures and symphonies, operetta, theater. And it's very much a thriving and successful country. It's also a country which can afford the leisure of being good-humored about itself. Ephraim Kishon has been one of the leading humorists and satirists of Israel the last quarter of a century. Recently, he put down this series of statements about his country, which begins this way. Israel is a country so tiny that there is no room to write its name on the world map. It is a country where mothers learned the mother tongue from their sons. It is a country where the fathers ate sour grapes and the children's teeth are excellent. It is a country where one writes Hebrew, reads English, and speaks Yiddish. It is a country where everybody has the right to speak his mind, but there is no law forcing anybody to listen. It is the most enlightened country in the region, thanks to the Arabs. It is a country where all the capital is concentrated in Jewish hands, and there is much grumbling because of this. It is a country which is an organic part of its trade unions. It is a country where nobody wants to work, so they build a new town in 3 days and go idle the rest of the week. It is a country which produces less than it eats, and yet of all places, it is here that nobody has ever died of hunger. It is a country where nobody believes in miracles, but everybody takes them for granted. It is a country where one calls ministers simply Moshe, and then almost dies with the excitement of it all. It is the only country in the region whose political regime is the bus cooperative. It is a country whose survival is permanently endangered, and yet its inhabitants' ulcers are caused by the neighbors from upstairs. It is a country where every human being is a soldier, and every soldier is a human being. Now, Israel has its share of domestic problems, and they are not unlike the problems of any emerging nation, of any country which is undergoing urbanization, where technology is coming to the fore. There's a drop in the value and the price of agricultural products and a rise in the cost of living, which is endangering much that is valuable in the kibbutz movement. It's a country where the press of children against the educational system, the demands for the expansion of that system, the demands for its refinement, exceed the capacity, the human resource of the society to provide grade A education for all. It's a country which has its share of poverty, associated primarily with the most recent immigrant group, the immigration from the Arab countries themselves, and where therefore there is a certain tension between these poorer, more recent immigrant Oriental Jews and those who have been there longer. It's a country where people drive too fast and have too many accidents. It's a country much like ours where there are all kinds of schemes for guaranteed automobile accident insurance, but none has yet come out, which protects the innocent and the careful driver. It's a country, in other words, much like every country of the globe, except, of course, for one thing. Israel is the only country on our globe whose neighbors have said, we will not tolerate her continued existence. Therefore, even at 23, the fullness of her pioneering strength, of her young manliness, we have to deal with questions of foreign affairs and international politics. The best way I know to deal with it is to deal with it in terms of the great superpowers of the world, the Soviet Union and the United States. Because in the Middle East, the great powers of the world, particularly the Soviet, have preempted control of affairs. If the Soviet had not poured in three times now tens of billions of dollars of most sophisticated weapons, there would be no threat of war. Some accommodation would have been worked out. And therefore, the response of the superpowers determines, in largest sense, the survival, the balance of power in that part of the world. The point that I want to make this morning is that Israel's policies at the age of 23, policies necessarily dictated by her primary responsibility to her own citizenry for survival, for defense, for the protection of what she has. These are running to a certain degree afoul of a certain urgency, a certain feeling in the air here in the United States, and that we must take this mood and these concerns into account. An old friend of mine, Judah Ibn Tibbon, who was the translator into Hebrew of Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed, once observed, "Ein nitzal ha'adam min ha'shichicha," that no man can be spared forgetting. Every day we forget something. As we grow older, we forget more. But forgetting is not simply a natural mechanism. Dr. Freud has taught us that our unconscious, to a certain degree, governs what we forget. We forget those moments in our lives when we were less than manly, less than at our best, and we forget those people who saw us at those moments. And as it is with men, so it is with nations. We tend to construct a myth about reality from which we have deliberately excluded, forgotten, those parts of reality which we would like most to overlook. Our country is mesmerized and traumatized by Vietnam, by the tragedy, by the death, by the defeat, by the frustration, by the ugliness of our own actions, and most of all, by an overwhelming sense of guilt. We have a feeling that somehow, if we had not had overarching, overweening imperial ambitions, that tragedy would not have taken place, and we tend to extrapolate from Vietnam to the rest of the world, to see international affairs simplistically, to believe that somehow if we would only withdraw our commitments, cease to be an imperial nation, a great power, turn our concerns to those things which are of concern to us here at home, somehow all the world would turn to right. Somehow everything that troubles us now would cease to trouble us, and we would have changed the economic and social priorities of our nation for the better. And so we overlook Chinese paramilitary troops in Thailand and in Burma. We overlook Soviet soldiers and pilots in Egypt and Syria. We see only our own commitments, our own technicians, our own involvement. And there is much in the mood of America, which is neo-isolationist, which asks us to withdraw, to pull back, to give ourselves a moment to bathe in our own sense of guilt, and to solve, on the more positive notion, to solve the very real domestic problems of our cities, of poverty and of race. Now the problem, of course, is that the world is not simply as it is, tortured and convulsed, because we are an imperial nation. Every nation is ambitious. Every nation is greedy. Every nation is imperial. Every nation is trying always to enlarge its markets, to enlarge its economic ambit, to take territory if it can be taken at very little cost. That's the way it has always been, and for the moment, that's the way it is. It is not only America that is imperial, it is Russia. It is not only Russia that is imperial, it is China. It is not only China that has international ambitions, it is France. It is not only France that has international ambitions, it is the Arab world. It is not only the Arab world which has international ambitions, it is Germany, and on and on and on. Our world is a world of greedy men grasping for greater glory. And unless we accept this fact, and unless we accept the reality that greed knows only one check, the check of somebody else's power, someone else's willingness to say, no, I will not bend before you, I will not surrender, I will not give in. Unless we accept that as the reality of our world, I'm afraid that we will find that we will withdraw, find a temporary breathing space, but soon find the problems of the world breathing down our neck as other countries move in to take more and more of what we have had. I can understand the mood in America. Vietnam has been a tragedy, a decade-long mistake of cosmic proportion. But I cannot understand the lack of an understanding that not all of our involvements are involvements of the nature of Vietnam. That our NATO involvements are very much different than Vietnam. That our Middle Eastern involvements are very much different than Vietnam. And that we must understand what is involved in each case and react not out of selective forgetfulness, but act out of wisdom and out of discrimination. Some weeks ago, Yale University, one of the doves on Vietnam, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Fulbright, spoke out in the mood which I have been describing. Senator Fulbright, unfortunately, has been one of the very few senior statesmen in America who has never had sympathy with and has never understood the rightness and fitness of the existence of the State of Israel. He has a long and sad history of blindness on this score. But he used this platform at Yale University to say this. He gave the Israelis full marks for honesty. But he said they have an overlong memory. And they use this overlong memory to engage in anti-communist baiting humbuggery. Those are his words. In which they try, as a client state, to twist the policies of the United States in a direction which was not according to our national interest. I want to examine this question of Israel's overlong memory. Because the whole contention which is being placed before us is this. That Israel is being adamant, mulish. Israel is not will not accept various guarantees made to it. If Israel will only withdraw to the borders of 1967, peace will descend upon the Middle East, and we cannot, as a peace-loving people, understand Israel's adamancy, Israel's stiff-neckedness in refusing to make these simple, swift, and complete concessions. Why does Israel not make these concessions? The reason lies precisely in Israel's realistic memory. Nations that want to forget, forget. Nations that are young and realistic do not blink at reality for what it is. They accept it for what it is and base their policy upon it, not upon some romantic notion, but upon reality itself. Now, if Israel were throwing up to the United States and to the world Kishinev, the pogroms of the 1880s. Pobudenestyev, the Russian minister who said that his solution to the Jewish problem was to exile one-third of the Jews, to starve to death one-third of the Jews, and to baptize one-third of the Jews of Russia. Yes, that would be an overlong memory. But when Israel speaks of the last 20 years, of the last 20 years of consistent Soviet anti-Israel propaganda, the last 20 years during which the Soviet has poured into the armies of Egypt and Syria and Iraq over $40 billion worth of the most sophisticated weapons in the world, if Israel is speaking of the last 20 years where the Soviet embassies throughout the world have been centers of anti-Israel propaganda wherever they exist, if they speak of the last 20 years when the Soviet Union, through its veto, has guaranteed at the United Nations that no resolution would be brought in condemning even terrorist attacks against Israel, is that an overlong memory? Perhaps it is. Let's talk of 15 years ago. If Israel talks of 50 years ago, when the Soviet encouraged Mr. Nasser to send his armies into the demilitarized zone at Gaza, precipitating the events of 1956 and 57, when Egypt provided Mr. Nasser with the fastest planes and missiles the world then had, when the Soviet Union began to engage in an anti-Semitic as well as anti-Zionist attack, when the Jews of silence became the Jews of silence, is that too long ago for a memory? But let's not talk of 15 years ago. Let's talk of 5 years, 6 years ago, when the Soviet ambassador in Israel went around in May of 1967 circulating rumors that he knew to be false as truth, that the Israeli army was massing on the Syrian border, therefore precipitating, about to attack, precipitating the events of May of 67, when the Soviet Union was encouraging its Egyptian and Syrian satellites to make the proper preparations for the third round against Israel. Is that too long a memory? Or shall we talk of 4 years ago, when Egypt and Syria lay defeated, prostrate, when there was some chance for some arrangement for negotiation, and the Soviet urged the Arab world to get together at Khartoum and to enunciate the Khartoum Declaration, no negotiations, no recognition, no peace. We will send to you the arms that you need to rebuild your armies for the fourth round against Israel. When the Soviet Union began a campaign now not of vilification only, but of vituperation against Israel, when it began to have a series of show trials of Jews in the Soviet Union, is that a long memory? Or a year ago, when Israeli pilots shot down Russian pilots in open combat over the Sinai, is that too long a memory? Or a month ago, it was announced to the world that the Soviet was sending to Egypt the MiG-23, introducing into the Middle East another generation of weapons, planes that could fly faster, further, at higher altitudes than any that was in the region. Are these overlong memories? Where can one find in the last 20 years a single example of Soviet policy which assumes the rightness, the fitness, the propriety of the existence of the State of Israel? And where can one find in the last 20 years any reason for Israel to trust in the guarantees which he is now being told to trust in as against geography, the guarantees of the great powers of the West? I give you 1957. You know the story well. In 1957, Israel came to the banks of the Suez, as she did again in 67. And the Russians pressured the United States, and Secretary Dulles pressured Israel. And Secretary Dulles made specific verbal commitments to Israel that if she withdrew from the Sinai, the Gaza would remain unmilitarized, the Suez Canal would be open to Israeli-bound ships, and the Straits of Tiran, Sharm el-Sheikh, would remain open to Israeli ships and Israeli-bound ships. And what happened? When Mr. Nasser moved his troops into the Gaza, when the Israeli ambassador made profession in Washington, he was told, we have other commitments. There's very little we can do now. We'll send you some food. We'll send you some new guns. And when the first ship was stopped from going through the Suez, which was bound with a cargo for Israel, and Israel's ambassador went to the State Department, what was he told? Well, there's really very little we can do. You don't want a third world war over this. We'll give you a few tons of food, and we'll give you some more guns. Perhaps that's over long a memory. That's 14 years ago. Let's talk of last August, when again there were guarantees. Israel was told that if she stopped responding to the Egyptian war of attrition, if there was a ceasefire, the ceasefire would be a standstill ceasefire. The Russian missiles would not be able to move into the zone from which her planes had blasted these missiles. There were specific guarantees to this effect. Israel accepted the ceasefire. And 1 minute after midnight in August, on the day when the ceasefire began, the Russian crews and the Russian missiles with their Egyptian guards moved into the standstill zone. And when Israel protested to the United States and asked for pressures to remove the guns, what was said? We don't have evidence of the violation. There were not even tests, overflights, to photograph whether or not the missile sites were being rebuilt. And when there was actual photographic proof that these missile sites had come to the banks of the Suez, the United States shook its head and said to Israel, what can we do? Yes, it was bad of the Russians. It was bad of the Egyptians. We'll send you some more planes. We'll send you some more guns. But what can we do? You don't want a third world war over this violation. So the guns are in place. And they now control the airspace over the Suez Canal, which makes it possible for the Egyptians to contemplate an amphibious attack into the Sinai should they wish to launch one. A strategic defeat was suffered by Israel because she trusted in Western guarantees, and the Western guarantees proved to be worth very little. Does Israel have an overlong memory? I wonder. A week ago in Yediot Aharonot, 2 weeks ago, one of the columnists wrote to this poem, which I think puts it all in fairly good context. Not long ago, our friends abroad were angrily inclined, and so I must admit was yours truly undersigned, to rage against the government and premier without cease for wanting all those territories instead of wanting peace. And now it happens that we read with definite relief the briefing in the Times in which the Premier turned a leaf. And we must confess, her words, if by intent or in effect, reflect those very principles we think must be correct. While all those warriors for peace who had their glorious hour have suddenly received a sort of glorious cold shower. For now it's clear, those territories over which we fought are not in fact as conquered or as annexed as we thought. And when you hear Egypt so solemnly announce she will not give up her homeland by a grain or by an ounce, it must occur to you to ask, if but for logic's sake, how many Egyptian fellaheen have land in Sharm el-Sheikh? And why should Egypt contest so limited a lease or not relinquish Sharm el-Sheikh if this could lead to peace? Unless they're really interested in having a replay of the exercise of 67 in the month of May. And so slowly there are questions that will raise their ugly heads and disturb us with their weightiness and haunt us in our beds, like the question which is strange and yet so simple in the end, such as, why not have such frontiers as we can best defend? In any way, why should the left consider it so right that Israel be defended by the power's concerted might? Ah, that with all the protests and petitions they've arrayed when left-wing splinters always join the anti-powers debate. They now want the Gaullist CIA and Russian secret police to be our keepers and our brothers' keepers in the Middle East. No, sirs, I think we can predict with every certainty that the instant peace our friends propose is of our eternity. Instant peace, the urgency for quick solutions, is the correlative of instant forgetfulness. of those who would like to forget the complexity, the involvement, the depth of the conflict in the Middle East, who believe that only were Israel to now withdraw to the borders of 67, all will sometime, somehow come well. What nonsense. Somehow this mood of forgetfulness in the United States has turned the new premier of Egypt, Mr. Sadat, into a man who is willing to make peace. And never has a reputation been built on such fragile foundations. When he came into office, within a week, he had told the army and he had told the public in Egypt that he would never, never, never negotiate with Israel. And he has never, never, never deviated from that purpose. Yes, yes, he did send a letter to Mr. Yaring, the United Nations intermediary, in which he said that under certain conditions, he would enter into certain arrangements with Israel, provided all Arab lands were returned to their rightful owners, and provided that no loss was made in the rights of the Palestinian peoples to their various legitimate claims. And this has been seized upon as a great compromise, a great statement for peace. This statement, which has been broadcast throughout the West, which is the foundation of Mr. Sadat's role as one who deserves the Nobel Peace Prize for 1971, was never translated into Arabic, has yet to be released to the press of the Egyptian peoples or to the press of the Iraqi or Syrian peoples. It exists only in the West. And to his own people, he continues to say what they know that he is in fact saying. That when I speak of the return of Arab lands, I'm not speaking simply of a return to the borders of 1967. That's only the first step. We will accomplish in that first step diplomatically what we need not accomplish by force of arms. We will force Israel back to very much longer borders. Our guns will be that much closer to her airfields and to her cities. Why do we need to lose soldiers for what we can achieve by international pressure? Arab lands means all of Israel. And after we've got Israel to move back to the borders of 67, we'll begin to press the international claim that she took more land in 1948 than she was given by the partition decision of 1947, and we'll demand the return of those lands, and we'll demand the return of Jerusalem, or at the very most, its internationalization, and then we'll press the Palestinian claim, which is that Israel must be a multinational state with only those Jews allowed in Israel who were there before 1917. That's what Mr. Sadat's great compromise amounts to. That the 100,000 Jews who lived in the land of Palestine before 1917 may somehow be allowed to remain there after the whole apparatus of the State of Israel has been dismantled. It's a multi-strategic approach. Political, through international pressure. Guerrilla, through the Fedayeen. Militarily, in the ultimate analysis, with a concerted attack at some point by the various Arab states. And as if to give proof what his real intentions were, Mr. Sadat, 3 weeks ago, went to Benghazi, and he signed a document of federation of Libya, Syria, and Egypt. And never has an international federation come into being for such belligerent purpose. These three countries represent some of the poorest, most benighted people on the face of the earth. And God knows they need to pool what oil wealth they have and what human resource they have for the natural development of their countries to raise their own standard of living. But what do these articles of incorporation say? We, the undersigned, agree that we will pool our military resources for war against Israel, for the holy cause, and we will not rest confident until that is achieved. And in the preamble to these Articles of Federation, what was said? No negotiations, no recognition, no peace. Khartoum, 1967. Now, this is Israel's reality. These are the facts that Israel refuses to forget, to blink away. But of course, you can have a memory and also have movement towards peace. Israel's position is not one of sheer adamancy, of sheer mulishness. Israel does not say, we trust in our guns and our guns alone. She has said again and again, let us negotiate face to face. Let us meet. Let us work out our agreements. There is nothing that cannot be negotiated, but the negotiations must be hard and realistic and not those simply of words, those simply which play into the Arab strategy. Israel accepts the reality of the Middle East for what it is, complex, belligerent, convulsed. She knows that there is no simple solution, no one act which will suddenly, apocalyptically bring peace. She knows that there is possibility, small possibility, but dim possibility, but possibility nonetheless. Abba Iban gave an interview to the press about 10 days ago, which is worth quoting to you. I think it wrong to say that the Arabs have advanced sufficiently to make the possibility of peace operative. But I do not go to the other extreme of saying that nothing has happened to them at all. I think it is significant for them to feel that they have to use concepts, words, and ideas that they refused to use before. Our impression is that Egypt is in a mood of liquidity. I will not give ourselves all the credit. I think our tenacity has had a good effect. I will give credit to other things, first of all to the United States, because they reduced the military option when they said that whatever the Soviets do to disturb this military balance, we will find ways of repairing it. That creates a skepticism about the military option. And secondly, the change of regime in Egypt itself. After all, we shouldn't be ashamed of being right sometimes. When Nasser died, everybody in the world went around with long faces and said that the hope of peace has perished. We said that without reference to the human aspect of it, a change of regime is objectively a new opportunity. Regimes don't like to be slavish followers of their predecessors. They like to criticize their predecessors by striking out in new directions. Another is this, that the Egyptians seem to be making a distinction between Egypt and the Arab world. They seem to say that their most sacred duty is to look after Egypt. And there may be a heightened consciousness of the fact that Nasser failed in the internal development of Egypt. Therefore, a successor has more of a chance of having something to show. I also think that the Jordan Civil War was a major event. It showed that the extremists were not as powerful, as irresistible as people thought. They were resistible. Nothing terrible happens if one resists them. So that there is movement, but it is hesitant, partial, and has not reached a point of readiness for genuinely free negotiations. I would say that this is the essence of the discussion between ourselves and the United States. Some in the United States say, here is a movement, hurry up, pluck this fruit, or else it will go away. We say, if there is fruit on the tree, we ought to rejoice in sober measure, but don't eat it until it's ripe, unless you want to get poisoned. And there very graphically is the division between the mood of forgetfulness, forgetful urgency, selective forgetfulness in the United States, and Israel's cold, realistic appraisal. There is some possibility. There is a dim light at the end of a long tunnel. But it's not today, and it will not come tomorrow, and it will not come the day after tomorrow. There needs to be vigilance and care and trust. Hope. Israel at 23. Israel at 23 has a lifetime already, many lifetimes of pioneering accomplishment. Israel at 23 represents the one underdeveloped nation of the world which has won its way into the light, which is now a developed nation. Israel at 23 represents 2.5 million people who have for that part of the world the highest standard of living, the highest standard of medicine, the highest standard of education of any people. A people who have a true democracy, a people who have maintained the freedoms of their own minorities, Arab, Christian, Druze, in a time of great tension. People who have a proud record. People who look to the freedom-loving peoples of the world for strength and encouragement during what will obviously be a difficult passage of time. On the one hand, you have the Soviet Union, imperial, ambitious, eager for the markets of the Middle East, eager to force open the Suez so that her ships can get into the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean, already successful in establishing submarine and destroyer bases in both Libya and in Egypt, already able to have established air bases in these countries for use in refueling flights. A great superpower whose troops have been actively committed to war against a small nation. On the other hand, you have the determination of the Israelis who have Ein Brera, no other alternative. Their hope that the well-intentioned peoples of the world will understand their skepticism of instant solutions, their willingness to negotiate, but their insistence that these negotiations be meaningful and sober and careful and realistic. And you have this urgency in the United States, which is sending Secretary Rogers here and there in the Arab world seeking some kind of instant solution to complex problems. You have a confusion of purposes, it would seem, in the United States. A willingness to provide certain kinds of economic aid and military hardware, and at the same time, an unwillingness to say unequivocally what is most urgently needed to be said if there is to be peace. We understand. We will not lean upon you until there is some kind of meaningful solution. That's the statement that would help to lighten the burden in the Middle East. Time now is on Israel's side. There were years in which many of us were afraid that time was running against Israel. It was only a matter of time till the weight of Arab arms and the weight of Arab numbers told, but it's patently clear that long before that moment would come, the weight of Arab frustration, of Arab poverty, of Arab lack of development will force these nations from their imperial designs against Egypt to deal with their domestic problems, which are their first urgency. Time is on Israel's side. That's why Sadat, Kosygin are playing the game that they do. Time is not necessarily bad for Israel. But Israel needs encouragement and she needs understanding. Our willingness to understand and not to give in to our own sense of frustration, our own desire to be quits of the problems of the world, our own desire to have the opportunity to think only of our own domestic situation. A great power does not have that luxury. And America is still the greatest superpower in the world. I close with a biblical illustration. It's night, a Judean village, and a single sentry on the wall. There's one who is laid abroad. He calls up to the sentry, Shomer Mamilayla, Shomer Mamilel, watchman, what of the night? Watchman, what of the night? The watchman turns and he looks out across the plain to the Judean hills. He sees the first light of the dawn, the first dim ray of light. And he calls back, Atta Boker Vagam Laila. The morning comes, but also another night. And that's been our understanding of history. It has opportunity. And it has responsibility. It has fulfillment, and it has frustration. They are intertwined. So it has been, and so it has ever been. The morning comes, but also the night. Amen.